Good morning, everyone. If you didn't make it for the 9 o'clock session, I'm hoping you're here for this 10 o'clock. This is the presentation on integrating financial and demographic longevity risk models. If you're not here for this, stay anyway, because it's bound to be interesting. The presenter today is Samuel Wills. Samuel did this as part of his honours thesis, so he'll spend a lot of time on it, more time than most of us have managed to spend on our papers today. And he's currently working as a management consultant for McKinsey, so we might see him back telling us all how to run our companies in a short time. I'll turn over to Samuel now. He's happy to take questions through the presentation, so no need to leave them all to the end. Thanks.
Okay, hi everyone. Thanks for coming along. As Brianne mentioned, my name's Sam Wills, and I worked on this as part of my honours thesis last year at the University of New South Wales. I apologise for the title. It's pretty boring. I'm going to try and sort of make sure that the presentation isn't as boring as the title. So basically, what I'm going to be talking about today is, as part of my thesis, I proposed a stochastic mortality model that can be basically used for in financial applications. So for pricing longevity and mortality-linked securities. And so what I'm going to endeavour to do through the course of the presentation today is start off by giving a little bit of an idea about why we'd be interested in thinking about these types of problems. Basically, what's the nature of longevity and mortality risk exposures in Australia, different ways of managing it, and where longevity risk securitisation comes into that sort of fold. After that, I was going to talk a little bit about the model that I proposed, and that model comes in three parts. So first of all, there is a mortality model component, which sort of is the stochastic mortality model that underpins the work that I've done. Then I've also proposed a model for developing a tranched longevity bond. And so I've performed a bit of analysis on that and then looked at pricing that bond using an empirical model proposed by Morton Lane in 2000. And so after sort of going through the theory, which I'll try and sort of keep to a minimum, I'll then jump into the analysis that I've done and present a few of the results that I've come up with. And hopefully I'd be very happy for any sort of questions or comments at the end. And I'll also sort of stop it at a few times just to sort of open it up for any clarifying questions as well. So to start off with, basically we can see that there's an increasing retail exposure to longevity risk in the Australian population. We see longevity improving with greater volatility, and we're all sort of familiar with the rectangularisation and expansion effects in the survival curve. As well as increasing longevity, there's been sort of stagnant or decreasing labour participation, so earlier sort of ages of retirement, so retirement ages are stretching, and there's also been a shift to defined contribution super funds. And so overall, there's been a tend to sort of see longevity risk being placed in the sort of the lives of the individual, in the hands of the individual, as opposed to the private or government sector. And so as a result of this, the AMP sort of superannuation adequacy index has estimated in 2007 that 3.4 million Australians at their current rates of saving will suffer from insufficient income in retirement, which makes up about one-third of the active labour force, which sort of provides a little bit of impetus for looking at this sort of stuff. And there's also a huge potential for investment in life annuities and other longevity-linked products. The Australian super industry is currently over $1 trillion in assets, whereas the Australian life annuity market is about $4 billion in assets. Everyone's fairly aware that there is a sort of significant scope for improvement in the managing the retail longevity risk exposures of individuals. However, there's been traditionally a number of constraints that have sort of prohibited the development of the retail longevity risk market. On the demand side, there are people have sort of been generating strong returns in the equity markets over the past 14 years. And also, people tend to sort of view their superannuation benefit as a personal asset that Nick Sherry was talking about yesterday. So people aren't really sort of willing to hand over any residual value in their superannuation benefits to a life company. And so they're more happy to manage it on their own accord and then sort of satisfy a bequeathment motive that they can pass on to their kids. On the supply side, insurers haven't been really willing to take on this type of risk due to the sort of uncertainty around longevity risk exposures, and reinsurers haven't wanted it either, some describing longevity risk as toxic. So based on that, I've sort of thought about what ways are there of managing the sort of longevity risk exposures of insurers and life annuity providers. And I've basically classed them into four different categories: avoidance, retention, transfer, and hedging. And I've put together a few examples of each there. Retention seems to be the most common approach at the moment, holding on your balance sheet and funding it with capital reserves or contingent capital. I was going to put on a fifth one, which was mitigating the risk, but I thought maybe mitigating longevity risk exposure probably wouldn't be the best idea because I think it involves sending out cigarette packets with all your annuity payments. I'm not sure how that would go over. So of these approaches, I've tried to focus on risk transfer and specifically securitisation. And I think that securitisation presents a number of benefits over other approaches. On the left-hand side there, I've just given a bit of an overview of securitisation as a vehicle for pure risk transfer in history. In recent times, there's been a lot of sort of innovation in the mortality space with mortality bond issues by Swiss Re through the Vita Capital issues and subsequent ones through the Tartan and Osiris SPVs. There's also been a proposed pure longevity risk survival bond issue that I've heard about by BNP Paribas and the European Investment Bank, but that failed in 2004, I think due to structuring problems because of basis risk. And that was sort of a little different to a longevity bond because that product was based on the EIB issuing a product that could sort of hedge the longevity risk exposures of annuity providers. So there was a sort of a basis risk element there. However, longevity risk securitisation presents a number of benefits. First of all, it has a high capacity for risk transfer because tranching the product broadens the appeal to investors and you're also getting access to the depth of the capital markets as opposed to the reinsurance market. The issue can also be tailored to manage the basis risk of the issuer because the issuer essentially structures the product based on their own longevity risk exposure. And you can sort of tailor it to your the age profile of your own annuitants, and also it presents a bit of a benefit to investors as well because pure longevity risk is considered to be sort of diversified when considered in terms of other assets as well. So I guess that's the motivation behind looking at this sort of stuff. Now jumping into sort of the modelling side of things, I've considered sort of. Just to sort of give a bit of background, three different potential models for mortality. The first of these is stochastic models for mortality. The first of these is the Lee Carter model, which is the industry standard and has been around for sort of over 15 years. And this is a few sort of innovations have been proposed in recent years to try and adapt this to modelling longevity-linked securities and to pricing these securities. However, there have been a few issues, specifically it's difficult to incorporate risk-neutral pricing with these models for mortality because it's difficult to include a sort of a price of longevity risk or mortality risk, and I'll just talk about that on the next slide. Moving on, there is a model proposed in 2004 by Dahl, and this is basically derived from finance theory, so the Vasacek and Cox-Ingersoll-Ross models, and it's taking an equivalent approach to those interest rate roles, models and applying it to the mortality to the issue of mortality. And because of its sort of background in financial literature, it's readily adapted to risk-neutral pricing, and though it does have a bit of a hurdle in terms of determining or calibrating the price of longevity risk. However, I have sort of the approach that I've taken is to adopt the Dahl model, and I've sort of made a few adjustments to it and sort of come up with a method of pricing and modelling a longevity bond. The third approach, just for matters of completeness, are forward rate models, which basically model the forward mortality surface, and they're sort of derived from the mortality equivalents of the interest rate models by Heath, Jarrell, and Morton. So, but they're sort of less developed in the financial literature at the moment, so I've tended to focus on the model B. Just going back to what I was talking about in terms of the Lee Carter model, because I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, there are difficulties in using this for pricing longevity-linked securities because basically how do you adjust the survival curve for how do you make a risk adjustment to the survival curve? And the method that's been proposed is using the Wang transform, which essentially it includes a sort of a distortion operator here and a distortion parameter, which essentially shifts the survival curve out by a certain sort of fixed parameter, and it sort of makes an equivalent sort of shift across the entire survival curve. The problem with this, of course, is that different investors will have different sort of risk profiles at different points in the survival curve, and so people may view sort of their longevity risk exposure to be higher at ages, 99 and 100 than it is at age, 30 and 40, or vice versa. So those differences aren't really captured in this sort of approach. And that's what I've tried to sort of overcome with the model that I'm proposing. Okay, so jumping into the model that I've proposed, what I've done is I've proposed a stochastic mortality model driven by a stochastic Brownian motion, and it's modelling the mortality rate as a function of the initial age x of each life in the annuity portfolio, and modelling it over time t. And so you can see here that the drift component in that stochastic mortality process is comprised of both, it has both an element of your initial age and also an element of time. And so the impact of this is that you can basically model a multi-age portfolio through time simultaneously. So you can sort of trace the development of different ages through time and sort of incorporate the dependence in the movements in those different ages and the improvements in longevity in those different ages. In order to incorporate that dependence, we've introduced a sort of a multivariate random vector DW, which is essentially, it's comprised of a multivariate random vector DZ, which is sort of each element of that is independent. And so the delta term there, it sort of is a correlation, it's a matrix of constants that incorporates correlation between each of those independent DZs. And so when you map those independent DZs with the matrix of constants delta, you get a dependent random vector DW. I'll just stop the presentation here and open up for any questions. Does anyone have any questions at this point?
Do you allow
selection? Yep. So basically what we're doing is we allow it, the model to sort of, I guess we assume that in the model that I've done, I've applied it to a population with an equal number of people between sort of ages 50 and 80, but depending on your own portfolio, you can sort of tailor this model to your own sort of your own risk exposure by the age of your initial cohorts.
Where are you getting the matrix constants from?
Yep, sure. Fantastic question. And let me answer it. So. Yep, nice. So what I've done is I've basically, the covariance matrix of the DWs is comprised of basically, I guess it's best to express it in matrix terms. So it's delta root DT. And the reason for that is all the DZs, they're independent, and so the only time that they sort of interact is when, you know, they're working on each other. Yep.
Just a question.
From the Lee-Carter model. Sure. Well, I guess the approach that this differs sort of fundamentally from the Lee-Carter approach in that it's based on a sort of interest rate models which have been applied to mortality, and so I haven't sort of not familiar with the use of PCA with the Lee-Carter model. I'd love to have a sort of look at it, but I'll have to sort of address it at the end. Okay, so basically, in order to determine the dependence between different ages, we've used the Kolesky decomposition, and then using principal components analysis, we're able to determine what the matrix of constants is, delta. And applying it to the data that I've used, you can see the sort of the eigenvectors and observed variation there, and you can see that at about 10, using 10 eigenvectors, you can sort of incorporate all the sort of, or 85% of the variability in the underlying population's mortality. The modelling that we've done has been based on 30 of those eigenvectors, but there is sort of scope to reduce the sort of dimension of the model and not sort of sacrifice too much accuracy. So, based on that's how we've come up with the sort of dependent structure for the model, and that's basically the overview that I was going to present on the theoretical side of the mortality model that we've proposed. So are there any other questions there just before I move on to the longevity bond model? Okay. Jumping into the longevity bond model, the longevity bond that we're proposing is designed to be issued by someone holding a portfolio of annuitants, and we're just assuming it's a portfolio of annuitants. Each annuitant is paid A per year, just for simplicity, and there are a number of lives So the annuity portfolio is made up of a number of lives of different ages, divided between sort of 50 and 80. And the design of the product is such that the bond pays investors a fixed amount, which reduces in the event of increasing longevity amongst the sort of the reference population. And those payments are then transferred to the issuer so they can cover the increased annuitant expenses to their annuitants. And all the investors subscribe their principal up front, and it's held in a collateral account so that you can sort of reduce the credit risk exposure of the issue. Now, the losses in the portfolio are based on the cumulative loss of the underlying annuity portfolio, which is the sum of the losses for each different cohort that you're using in your reference portfolio divided by the face value of the bond itself. And so you can see from this model, it's based on a multi-age portfolio, which differs from past analysis in the literature of longevity bond models, which have been based on single-age portfolios. And it allows for variability in the underlying population mortality rate, TPX. And you can see that from this stuff down here. So the loss is basically the difference between the actual number of lives alive at each time minus the expected number of lives alive at each time. And we've sort of approximated that by the initial number of lives alive times the probability that they'll survive for 10 years. In doing that, we've sort of sacrificed a little bit of the sort of variability in the underlying population's mortality exposure, and I'll explain that just here. So the total variability in the number of lives alive at any time is made up of two components. First of all, there is the underlying variability in TPX, the population mortality rate, and then there's also the binomial variability in the portfolio given a fixed TPX. And so what we've done is we've just focused on the former, which is the underlying population variability in the underlying population mortality rate. And this differs from previous attempts at modelling longevity bonds as well, because they've just focused on the binomial variability given a fixed TPX. However, we found that sort of when you compare it, that the partial variance, like that attributed just to the underlying variability in the population mortality rate, almost completely explains the total variability of the population's mortality. And so, as a result, we think that this is sort of a reasonable approximation, ignoring the binomial variability in the underlying population. And it sort of also has a number of benefits in terms of modelling as well. Are there any questions at this point? Okay. Well, I'll keep moving on then. Okay, so as part of this model, we've also introduced some tranches. And so what we've done is we've divided it up into three different tranches based on the sort of the cumulative loss of the entire portfolio over time. And so I guess the best way to explain it is visually, as you can see on the bottom right-hand corner. That's basically sort of simulations of the total cumulative loss of the portfolio. And as those increase, those cumulative losses, they'll hit sort of thresholds. And once it exceeds a threshold, you'll retire a tranche and then move into the next tranche. And so you can just sort of see it flowing through the three tranches that we've divided it up into. And we've then sort of, we're going to be expressing our tranche cumulative loss, TCL, as the expected cumulative loss as a sort of percentage of the sort of the exposure of that tranche. So you divide it by sort of, you know, the width of the tranche itself. Now, moving on to the pricing model, in order to price this product, we've basically equated the premium leg, so the premiums that are paid to investors, and the loss leg, so what the investors are looking to sacrifice in the event that longevity improves. And the premium leg is made up of, so premium leg is PL, it's made up of the premium P, the B term is the price of a zero coupon bond at the start of the period, and 1 minus TCL is essentially the remaining principal left in that tranche at the beginning of the period. The loss leg, on the other hand, is the first term is the zero coupon bond, discount it back, and it's the losses that are incurred in that period. So it's the cumulative loss at the end of the period, that's the cumulative loss at the start of the period. And we're looking at for the premium that equates those two legs. However, we know that the premiums need to be set under a risk-adjusted Q measure. And so looking back into the theory, we know that if we're going to adjust our underlying Brownian motion to make it a Q mortality measure, we have to make a risk adjustment to the underlying process, which you can sort of see described just here. And that adjustment is lambda, the term lambda. And so what this model allows is for you to use a different risk adjustment for every age, and it can also change over time. Granted that the sort of I'll talk about that a little bit later, but so there is the possibility to sort of incorporate a range of different risk adjustments for all different ages so that you can incorporate in different investor sentiments at different points in the survival curve. And so the result of that is that when you're looking at the mortality process under the risk adjustment, the risk-adjusted mortality process, the drift is adjusted by this risk adjustment term here. And that's sort of, I guess, intuitively follows because we're basically shifting the sort of development of the mortality process by a certain risk adjustment in order to incorporate the sort of market price for longevity risk. Are there any questions at this point? So it's sort of the expectation of the rate of mortality improvement. You can see that if you sort of divide the graph by mu on the right-hand side, you get the rate of mortality improvement. And this is the sort of... I apologise, there's too many equations in the presentation, but we'll try and get away from them right now. Well, one more page. Okay. So what we've done is there is a problem in calibrating this model. Basically, when you sort of the choice of the Q mortality process isn't unique. Basically, like interest rate derivatives, the mortality process under Q isn't a martingale measure. Rather, the loss process on each tranche is going to be a martingale because you're discounting the losses in each tranche by the risk-free rate as opposed to the mortality rate. You don't discount that by the risk-free rate. And so we can't use the general sort of pricing methods by determining by sort of finding a unique Q under a martingale measure. And so we've just got to calibrate it to sort of market sentiment. And to do this, what I've done is I've used an empirical model proposed by Lane, who does a lot of analysis of pure risk transfer in the sort of cat risk market and the sort of mortality bond market. And so what I've done is I've taken the existing mortality bond issues and I've sort of fit Lane's model, which basically says that the premium of an issue is made up of the expected loss here and an expected excess return, which is a function of the probability of first loss and the cumulative expected loss in each tranche. So the probability that loss will attach and the loss given the tranche attaches. So what I've done is I've fit that model to existing mortality bond issues. I've come up with a few parameters there, and then I have sort of calibrated my risk adjustment lambda to that work, to that model. To do so, I've had to make a few simplifying assumptions because basically allowing for a different price of risk at every point in the survival curve and changing over time is sort of exceeds the amount of available data on people's sort of appetite for longevity risk. So I've had to sort of just use a fixed sort of price of longevity risk for all ages at all times. But the benefit of the model is that in the future, if a mortality or a longevity risk market develops, people will be able to start sort of tailoring what their appetite for longevity risk is at each point in the curve and applying it into this model. So based on that, now we get into the fun stuff. I've done a bit of modelling. These are the data. Basically, I've used Australian population mortality data, aged between 50 and 99, because we're looking at longevity risk. And I've modelled it under three different dependence assumptions. So when I talk about age dependence, what I mean is that a mortality improvement at age 55 will also have an impact on mortality improvements at age 53, 54, 60, 99. And so I've sort of used three different ways of modelling that age dependence. First of all is perfect age independence. So a mortality improvement at age 50 has no bearing on ages 49 or 51. Perfect age dependence, which means that a mortality improvement at age 50 is reflected proportionately across the entire survival curve. and also observed age dependence, which we talked about a little bit before, using principal components analysis to determine that the value of that delta matrix of constants. And so the aim of this is just to show the sort of the importance of getting the age dependence right in these types of models. So some of the results that I've put together. In this you can see in the top left, this is basically some projections of the mortality model over the next 20 years. And you can see that the population sort of moves throughout the sort of age time space. So as each life gets older, it also moves through time. You can see the ridges that occur through the mortality space as a result of that. And you can also see, I guess it's best seen at older ages, that mortality is expected to continue improving into the future. Here we have sort of 95% bounds for the forced mortality after 5 years. And you can see that the black line is the current forced mortality. The blue line is the expectation of it. And the bounds are very light. But you can see the bounds under each of those age dependence assumptions. And basically, what you can take away from those bounds is that it's most variable under perfect age dependence, as you'd expect, because you know if there's a sort of increase in longevity at one age, it's reflected across the entire survival curve, so there's no sort of offsetting. However, at the oldest ages, sort of 95 to 100, we found that the observed age dependence gives a lot of variability in the sort of longevity predictions of those ages. So there's a lot of variability between ages 95 and 100, and we'll sort of see that reflected in a couple more slides. Now, what I'm trying to show here is I've done a bit of analysis to show the quality of the fit of the mortality model. And in the top left corner, you can see that these are the residuals from fitting the model, and they tend to be, there's no sort of trends in either the age or time dimension, which sort of suggests that our drift component is capturing the trends across age and time. The residuals are distributed with mean 0 and standard deviation 1. There's low asymptotic variance and covariance, as you can see by the really small numbers in these matrices. And the Pearson's chi-squared stat, which is a sort of a more simple measure, shows that the model fits the observed data very well. And in terms of incorporating the dependence, you remember before I mentioned that we used 30 of the eigenvectors, which incorporate 99% of the variability in the underlying sort of population mortality. So basically, I think that the model fits the observed data very well, and so it gives me sort of confidence in the projections that we've made using it. Now, looking at the longevity bond, and I found this stuff really interesting. So basically, the first column is just looking at the portfolio expected cumulative loss. So this is this is basically what you're expecting the losses to be over time for the entire annuity portfolio. And the blue lines are based on our observed age dependence structures. The red ones just for independent age dependence, and this is for perfectly dependent ages. So I guess focusing on the blue lines will sort of give an idea of what we're actually expecting, and the other two give it an idea of what the impact of age dependence has on this modelling. And so you can see here that for a junior tranche, the junior tranche will be used up to sort of 15% of losses, of the entire losses of the portfolio. You can expect to lose over sort of 50% of the entire principal of that loss over 20 years. For sort of, I think we aim to get this, the second tranche rated around a sort of a double B minus sort of level, and you expect to lose, I think it was about sort of 15-20% of your total principal by the end of the 20 years. And for your AAA rated bond, the senior tranche, you expect to lose none of it, but there is some sort of there is variability around that. So what we've presented here is we've given a bit of an analysis of the risk profile of the different tranches of a longevity bond. Now, what we have here are sort of the total losses of the entire annuity portfolio. What I thought would be interesting is if I disaggregate that by the contributions that are made by different ages, so you can see what sort of parts of that sort of initial cohort are contributing the most longevity risk to our portfolio. And this middle row here describes what we did under our sort of observed age dependence. And you can see that the older ages contribute the most variability, or that they contribute the most losses to the portfolio due to the higher variability in the you know, mortality rates at higher ages. And you can see even at the highest, the senior tranche, the higher ages are contributing so much and the lower ages contributing such little sort of losses to that highest tranche because, you know, they're not sort of ratcheting up to sort of losing 30% of those initial sort of cohorts, that the younger ages are offsetting the losses in the older ages, hence the sort of the negative dip down towards the lower ages. So I guess that's what I tend to take away from those plots there the most. Okay, now jumping into the pricing model. Now, the prices we basically determined using the empirical lane model. And so the prices are basically taken from that, and we just calibrated our model so that we achieved the same prices as them. So basically we were saying that for a product with the same sort of, for each tranche, with the same sort of risk profile as ones in the market, what would the price be? I guess the major analysis we took away from this is the what effect does our empirical model have on our choice of risk adjustment? And we found that basically there is quite a bit of impact on your choice of risk adjustment, so you really do have to get an idea about what the market's appetite for longevity risk is before doing this. And so I think the only way to do that in reality is to actually go out and start feeling the market for, you know, how much people would be willing to pay to or be willing to need to receive in order to take on longevity risk. Okay, so the implications of the results. Mortality can effectively be... No worries. Last ringtone. Okay, so the results basically imply that mortality can effectively be modelled as a dynamic multi-age process. And I guess one of the major contributions of the work is that the fact that we're modelling it as a multi-age process that traces through age and time, and it can also be used to in financial applications, so for modelling and pricing longevity-linked securities. Tranche longevity bonds provide an effective vehicle for managing longevity risk. As you can see from the line plots that we saw earlier on, there is a huge difference. I'll get them up again. There is a huge difference between this sort of risk profile and the three risk profiles that you sort of split it up into once you divide it up into tranches. So there is, as you'd sort of expect from our knowledge of CDOs and other securitisation issues. And dynamic mortality models are well suited to pricing longevity-linked securities because you're able to incorporate a different price of risk at different points in the survival curve, and it's readily reconciled to other stochastic financial models, particularly those for interest rates and things like that. So there is a sort of a theoretical sort of level playing field in that sort of area. Areas for further research would be calibrating the risk-adjusted mortality process. And as I mentioned before, I think the best way to do this is to actually go out, start talking to people and start feeling out what their actual appetite for longevity risk is. Applying the proposed mortality model to a broader range of ages, so to see if we're able to model sort of the sort of traditional term life insurance portfolios as well using this, you know, the ages between sort of 30 and 50, stuff like that. And also investigating alternative definitions of portfolio loss. So rather than just the cumulative loss in the portfolio at each point in time, basing it on changes in the sort of future annuity liabilities, so you're having a more forward-looking approach than just the losses that you incur at each year. We fit the Dahl framework successfully to changes in mortality by age and time simultaneously. We've verified that getting the right age dependence is crucial, and so the use of principal components analysis in order to determine that is was found to be a good way of determining it. And in doing this, using this mortality model will facilitate the sort of analysis of longevity-linked securities, determining their risk profiles and things like that. For the longevity bond, we've given a bit of an indication that it seems to be a good way of structuring longevity risk in that you're able to sort of dice it up into a few different tranches and they have very different risk profiles. And we've performed a sort of a pretty detailed analysis of the impact of tranching under a range of age dependence assumptions. And in terms of pricing, the calibrated price of risk was consistent with risk-averse investors with nonlinear risk-return trade-off. And you can see that through the nature of this slope in the risk adjustments. Yeah, so the slope of the risk adjustments means that people have a higher price of risk relative, given for the lower tranches, because they know that they're really going to get hit on the low tranche, so they place a disproportionately high price of risk on that, and they place a proportionately lower price of risk on the higher tranches because, you know, it's a sort of a non-linear sort of payoff. It looks linear, but it's because sort of people don't apply the same risk profile to each level of risk. And finally, the price of risk is able to vary by age and time to incorporate a range of investor sentiments. But obviously, we haven't been able to incorporate that because we don't know what investor sentiment is yet. So that brings me to the end of the presentation. There's a few references there, so if anyone wants to sort of further look it up, it'll be on the website. You don't need to read them now. And any questions or comments, I'd love to hear them. Okay, sure. We didn't actually apply that, but I think that's a great piece of analysis that sounds like a fantastic piece of work to follow on with. What we did do is we tried a number of different... Basically, what we've done is we've provided a parameterisation of a general model, and that parameterisation we found fit the proposed data very well, basing it on that drift sort of function there. There is a sort of more general model that's been proposed by Dahl, but it hasn't actually been parameterised so it can fit age and time at the same time. So I guess, I think that would be a great and further piece of analysis. Thanks for that. Yep, sure. We also, like the Lee Carter model does incorporate a different sort of parameter for every, sort of two extra parameters for every age as well. But you're right. I think the 10 parameter approach. We did a bit of analysis on that, and it seemed to generate pretty reasonable results as well, like the 10 eigenvector approach. So, in terms of practice, I think that'd be the best approach for applying it. But thanks for that comment. Okay, sure. I think the second question seemed to be quite similar to the first question we had. Yeah, there is definitely more scope for testing it. As I mentioned, one of the areas for further analysis would be testing it on the ages, sort of the traditional life annuity ages, and testing it for other populations as well. So that's definitely an area for further research. In terms of the drift function, we found it was a sort of fairly simple method of describing drift, basing it on, so this X here is the initial age of the cohort, and T is the time that's elapsed. So basically this is the current age of the cohort at each point in time, and we've just sort of fitted a linear drift to that because we thought it was relatively simple and it seemed to fit the data well. So that was the motivation for it. But again, definitely further area for research in sort of really testing this against other populations and things like that. Yeah, great question. We have seen that there is sort of greater variability in the mortality rates at the highest ages. So up here you can see that the bounds of the expected mortality rate are sort of a lot wider at higher ages. So as you'd expect sort of for ages 95 to 100, because there are so few data points, there's a lot of variability around what their forced mortality is. But when we apply it to this, we can see that at time zero... If I could, I'd like to sort of pose a question to you guys. Do you think, how would be the best approach to go about sort of determining what people's appetite for longevity risk would be? Has anyone sort of done any work into it, or do you think there's a scope for doing any of that sort of work?
Convincing
people. And do you think, so is that similar to sort of the longevity option, the retail longevity option that we've sort of heard a little bit about? So people just paying a sort of a premium to receive, rather than their whole capital, they just pay a premium to get the sort of the option in the future.
People are much more comfortable paying that.
Yeah. And so what about on the sort of, on the wholesale side, how would you go about managing the longevity risk once you hold it on your balance sheet?
Well, that's right, and that's where these sort of prices are going to
work. Fantastic. And so does that seem to be the general consensus, that in order for this sort of market to develop, we need to develop the retail and the wholesale markets at the same time, or do you first need to develop a critical mass in the retail market before we can start securitising it off. Would that...
I think that's the additional issue, which is the asset side, that you, if you're going to develop a significant market in this, you need the assets to back it, which we're currently lacking. And the I think the real critical issue to a securitisation is education of analysts, because basically that presentation lost me as well as some of the other audience members of the audience.
And
we'd like to... perhaps unfairly consider ourselves, or unjustifiably consider ourselves, you know, at the meaty end of the financial market. So how do you sell something this complex in a securitisation method on the first presentation yesterday was, I think someone from CBA, in fact, said quite clearly that successful securitisations have a very, very simple product. And I just wonder how we'd sell that, particularly as the information which was coming back was suggesting that you can only ever, when you do it in tranches, you only ever manage to get rid of the top one or two tranches, and the lower tranches you end up having to take back yourself because the investment markets are not interested in sort of the triple B stuff. They're only interested in the AA or AAA.
Yep, definitely. Just on that, I think you made a very valid point. I think the mortality model is a sort of a difficult thing to communicate. I think, however, that the longevity bond itself is probably quite easily marketable because it seems to be quite similar to sort of CDOs and things like that. Realistically, all it is just taking premium payments from the investor, handing it off to the annuitants. And so the analysis behind it is quite complex, but I think the sort of the investors needn't know the analysis. They just need to know what the risk profile of each tranche is and that sort of thing. I think that can sort of... That's providing enough information in that space would sort of facilitate the development of the product.
Cash flows are
right? Definitely. So what we've proposed is the same approach that Swiss Re have used in their sort of Vita capital issues. So you take a reference portfolio and you say, okay, we've got 50% people aged 60, 45% people aged 65, and 5% people aged 70 or something like that. And then rather than using your sort of experienced mortality, you go off to a sort of a reference index like the Australian population mortality and say, OK, we're just going to take 50% of the Australian population mortality at age 60, 45 at age 65, and 5% at age 70. So you're managing the basis risk because the issue is based on the same lives as your, like the same sort of age mix as your own portfolio, but you're also managing information asymmetry because you're providing it based on a sort of a population-wide index. And so there is a balance there to make it accessible for investors while managing the risk of the issuer.
So the actual experience
should start with all kind of... Yeah, so we were looking at that, and we basically said that for an annuity portfolio of 50,000 annuities or something like that, I think was the assumption that we used. 60,000 at each age... we found that the binomial variability didn't make much impact at all.
Okay. My second question was life insurance. It's very different.
Yeah, that was the idea. We were designing to sort of not securitise the whole portfolio itself, just the pure longevity risk in that portfolio. So it could be equally applied to things like longevity options and things like that. But yeah, we were focused on probably issuance by a large retail insurer rather than a reinsurer where perhaps the mix maybe get a little bit sort of complicated, like this sort of annuity mix when they're taken from all different different sort of retail insurers. I think, that's how he designed it. So issued by a large retail insurer with sort of maybe the support of an investment bank for, getting access into the market and things like that.
I think we have time for one more question. Should you know you're around?
Both very good points. So on the first point, you're exactly right. There is a bit of a perverse incentive that arises because the investors are looking sort of for longevity not to increase. So it's not that longevity shouldn't increase. It just shouldn't increase more than is expected. So that's what they're sort of managing against. And you're right, it's a perverse incentive, but the alternative way of looking at it is that this product provides diversification for investors, but it also helps relieves the supply constraint for insurers issuing these products. And so although it creates sort of perverse incentives for the investor, they don't really do anything about it. But on the other side, on the retail side, it gives access to retail investors, give them ways of managing their longevity risk at reasonable prices because the risk can be transferred off to the capital markets. So I guess that's where the sort of social motivation for the product comes from. And the second point in the sort of refinancing risk, you're right, I think that's definitely a valid concern and comes down to the sort of the product design. So the term of the product, how you design it, which at the moment is restricted by the length of government bonds in Australia. It also, so I think that that's definitely a risk that we've got to sort of consider in terms of how we're going to structure it. Yeah, you're exactly right. There's definitely, this could sort of facilitate, I guess there is a natural hedge that exists between term life and life annuity products.
But you could actually make a transfer of capital.
Exactly, yeah, this could sort of facilitate that. There is the sort of the fact that the populations are different in each of the different products, but yeah, there's definitely scope for using it.
But my second point was...
That's definitely a good question. If there was a fundamental shift in the nature of mortality, then I think you'd have to reassess the mortality model because you are sort of pricing it based on past experience because that's how you're parameterising it, yeah. So I think you would have to sort of re-parameterise the model, but I think, yeah, that would definitely be a concern. But you would hope that sort of shift is within the scope of the variability that you've built in your analysis.
Would the investor have to put more money in?
I guess if that sort of happened, I think you would be facing losses as the issuer because there is no more scope for like transferring out that like because it's unlikely that they would start hitting those tranches again. But on the other hand, your annuity portfolio isn't going to experience the same sort of weather. No, I think you're right. Yeah, they may very well have to take on more capital, I think.
Okay, really is the last question.
Yep. I think I put too many equations up on the board just to bamboozle you guys, but I apologise for that.
John, you just got to give him some compensation.
Exactly right. I have nothing. Had another thought on the point that you made on the sort of the refinancing of the issue. I think in terms of refinancing, it would be the investor rather than the annuitant who would have to sort of worry about the refinancing risk because the annuitant itself, they don't really have any sort of explicit relationship with the longevity bond itself. So it would only be the investor who's facing that sort of refinancing risk. So the risk, I think the way of managing that, as you said, sort of, so to avoid, for that sort of extra capital to come on board, you would have to exceed every single one of those tranches to their sort of full capacity. And so that comes down to how you design the product, what the sort of maximum sort of 1 in 1,000 year event is that you're sort of setting your sort of top capital subscription to be. And so in the event that that's exceeded, chances are like the product stops working because you've exceeded the entire scope, like the entire width of the issue. But in reality, I don't think that sort of... You'd be managing to sort of a 1 in 1,000 year, 1 in 10,000 year sort of event to sort of exhaust every single tranche.
And on that note, we might thank Samuel for his excellent presentation.